Richard Neupert is a professor of the arts in the Department of Theater and Film Studies at the University of Georgia, and his books include French Animation History and A History of the French New Wave. This is Richard Neupert. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I'm here with Richard Neupert. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Of course.
So you wrote A History of French New Wave Cinema, and it's always fascinating to me when you have these sort of bursts of creative geniuses in history. Like, why in 17th century Florence were all these world historic artists just like accumulating in one city? New York in the 50s, abstract expressionism. Like, even apparently stand-up comedians talk about Boston in the 80s was like a haven. So first off, I want to discuss why that happened. But for people who are uninitiated, or even people who have watched French New Wave movies, what is the French New Wave? What are we even talking about here?
Yeah, the French New Wave is a label for a number of films and filmmakers, auteurs, as they say, individual kind of creative filmmakers or auteurs in France, who made their first feature films and really got active during the late 1950s into the mid 1960s. So it was a period of a bunch of new people coming into the industry, which had never really happened before, and frankly, it's never quite happened since. One way to describe it would be a lot of new, uncommercial, untested filmmakers got a chance to make feature films. And in fact, about 120 different people made a first feature film within a five-year period from 58 to 63. And again, that's never happened in Hollywood, where you get a whole bunch of first-time directors. Yeah. So it was really a bunch of different movies, and these were films that were seen as sort of youthful, breaking a lot of rules, kind of sexy, artsy, but also fun. And it really kind of changed people's perceptions of who could make a movie, where, and why. But it really is a period of a few years. And then a lot of these people end up being major filmmakers for the next 30, 40 years and much more commercial. But the new wave itself is really this period of, as you said, a sort of excitement, a burst of energy, of creative energy. And it sort of changed the landscape for film history in lots of different ways.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that you look at movies that came before then, and even directors who I really like Alfred Hitchcock, is kind of even just the music that they use is very, it feels very dated to listen to it now.
Symphonic and carefully, it was composed for the movies, and yes, that's different than the new wave, I think. So just in terms of Hitchcock, I mean, they loved Alfred Hitchcock, but they didn't want to remake necessarily a Hitchcock film. They loved the energy in a Hitchcock, and they loved certain aspects of Hitchcock films. But you're right, the French New Wave, one of the things that set them apart, in fact, was this notion that they liked loose, spontaneous stories about contemporary events. They don't tell stories that are set in medieval times. They don't tell World War I stories, except for Jules and Jim, I guess. They tended to be contemporary. So they use contemporary music. They're going to use jazz music that's also loose and rambling, just like their characters who are meandering through Paris. Or they use pop music. So they can't afford a big composer at this point. Those who do get some new young person to compose, and then they end up maybe using them over and over and over, and you get a couple of composers who come out of this who are really, really famous. But they don't take expensive composers and ask them to come work on their film. So these are things made outside the studio system. These are things that were made really on the cheap, almost like really nice student movies to a certain extent. They're really independent movies before we had a term for like the American independent cinema of the 80s and 90s. These guys were, and a couple women, were really the blueprint for, or provided the blueprint for Jim Jarmusch and Wayne Wang and all kinds of independent filmmakers, Soderbergh, et cetera, who came out later on.
Yeah, and there's so many different aspects of it that just feel very fresh, even watching these movies today, where it's like the dialogue. If you look at like Vertigo, I watched that, I was lucky enough to watch in the theater recently. And even the way people are talking to each other is very, hello, sir. And it just feels stiff, you know.
It's rehearsed. And again, they love Hitchcock and a lot of things about it, and I love Hitchcock, but it's very rehearsed. Actors hit their line. The cinematographers know exactly where they're going to be when they say that line, so they have the lighting just set just right, etc. The New Wave people were breaking a lot of rules and being much more spontaneous. They were also not popular with the unions. They were doing something that couldn't easily have gotten away with in the United States, that they started to get rid of some union positions. They're like, we can't afford a costume designer. You know, she'll bring her own, she'll wear her own dresses. So you get this sort of naturalism and low key stuff. So not only do they, you know, come up with music that's going to be a cheaper alternative, they're going to try to do away with shooting in studios whenever possible. You shoot on location. And a lot of these people actually end up, you know, shooting their friends' apartments. They shoot in their parents' houses out in the country or their grandmother's house. They shoot in the streets or cafes they go to. So they're not going into studios. They're not having actors walk up and hit a mark and suddenly be in perfect three-point lighting as they deliver their eloquently written dialogue as well. And some of it's improvisational in terms of dialogue. Some of it's shot silent and they put the dialogue in later. You can see their lips moving, but it doesn't always say exactly what they say. So they were made in a really loose kind of format that was seen as unprofessional by a bunch of people. But you're right about some of it doesn't seem very dated because they use contemporary slang. They're wearing just regular clothes that regular teenagers and 20-year-olds would be wearing. It doesn't look like a manufactured universe, I think. And that inspired a lot of student filmmakers too.
Yeah. What is the phrase that my French is poor, so I'm probably going to mispronounce this guy's name, but Jean-Luc Godard, uses this phrase.
Jean-Luc Godard. Yes.
Jean-Luc Godard, tradition of quality. Is that kind of what they're referring to there?
They're reacting against. So basically, these are people who, in after World War, it's a whole new generation. And first, we should say there was a new wave going on in a bunch of different areas. There's the equivalent of Newsweek or Time magazine really labeled this a new wave generation, that there was a new wave in music. There was a new wave in theater, Waiting for Godot and things. We're breaking all the rules from how you staged a play. And new wave literature, there were a lot of new young people writing novels as well. Françoise Sagan, this young woman, is writing, she's like 18 years old and has one of the top novels in France in the 1950s. And people were saying, hey, we got like all these young people doing all kinds of new stuff. What about cinema? And there were a number of very important young auteurs, but a few of them. And it's really like people are expecting now cinema to sort of do the same thing the other arts are doing. And what they do is reject a lot of the usual rules. And Jean-Luc Godard is a perfect example. He said early on in his career, the best thing that ever happened to me was I got turned down by the National Film School. Like, everybody wants to go to EDEC then. It was like the great place. He said, if I'd gone to film school, I would have learned how to set my lights up just like everybody else. I would have learned how to build a story just like everybody else. I would have learned where to put my camera just like everybody else. He says, I didn't do that, and I don't have to follow those rules. So that's that kind of modernism of breaking away from tradition and convention and trying to tell a more personal story. So Jean-Luc Godard, he's really famous, for example, in Breathless, one of the great, great movies of 1960 that really got international attention and made a bunch of stars out of people who had minor roles before. But he's for a couple of scenes, he's going to put the camera operator in a wheelchair and just like push them not only around a room because he couldn't afford a track and a dolly and stuff like that, but even down the street. They go to the Champs-Élysées, the most elegant big street in Paris. They're just shooting. He's got somebody hiding the camera operator inside of a little buggy thing, and it's just pushing them down the street while he shoots the actors. People didn't even know a movie was being shot while he's out there sometimes. So it's a real improvisational kind of method. Same thing with François Truffaut. He shoots 400 blows, most of it shot on the streets, following these kids running around and getting into scrapes and having problems. And he's going to also hire somebody who is better at documentary filmmaking, somebody who didn't know how to use a big 35mm camera the same way the Hitchcock cinematographers might. They were used to news gathering and documentary. And for technology, what they're doing, a bunch of these directors end up shooting in 35mm and sometimes 16. So for 35 is the professional level, but they're not using gigantic big Technicolor or Mitchell cameras. They're using small cameras that were just coming on the market for news gathering. So they're shooting their movies with a small camera that's made for being mobile to go cover a demonstration or something in Paris, they're shooting fiction films with them, and they're hooked up to a tiny little 15-pound tape recorder, a magnetic tape recorder with two discs that was also really cheap to operate. So suddenly a camera crew is one guy with a camera on his shoulder who's hooked up to another person, often a young woman, with the tape recorder, and they can get into elevators, they can jump onto into buses, they can run down the stairs and follow these characters. So it's a real fluid kind of storytelling, a real fluid kind of technology, and it's cheap. They're trying to do these things on the cheap. So they're making movies for $50,000, $60,000, when a Hollywood movie might be $800,000. Yeah. And they're making money and they're winning awards. And that's what kind of gave this attention to who are these young people who've been writing criticism and being reviewing films in a journal, and suddenly they're making movies. And then producers come along and say, geez, this guy made this movie for $50,000 and it's making millions. I got $100,000. I can make two movies. Yeah. And they started looking for new talent. Jean-Luc Godard gets done with Breathless, and his producer said, do you have any friends who want to make movies? Like, this never happened. And he says, yeah, my friend Jacques Demy here's got a great script. And he introduced him to Jacques Demy, and he makes Jacques Demy's first film for $100,000. And Jacques Demy's girlfriend at that point, Agnès Varda, says, well, I've got a script too. So they're going to produce her first film, her first feature. So you end up having this sort of network of friends who get it started rolling and help each other out. And they're actors who are going to be in each other's movies. And then you get producers who are going to be a whole new generation of producers taking chances on risky ventures, but that are cheap. So you make three movies. One producer said, I can make three movies for $200,000. And if one of them makes money, I'm doing well. But I can also make one $200,000 movie, and I got all my money in one basket. And if it doesn't do well, I'm ruined. So there was this kind of new sense even of, you know, new producers, a new wave of producers, a new wave of actors who, you know, don't have wigs and stuff. They just show up in their own, the women do their own hair in a lot of these movies. And you got a new wave of writer and directors.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Well, as you're saying this, one of the things that's so different about film as opposed to any other art form, like if you wanted to write a novel, no one is stopping you. You can sit down and you can get out a piece of paper and you can just write. And, I'm obviously more than one piece of paper, but you know.
Yeah. But no, you don't have a gatekeeper in the same.
Exactly. Way. But with film, you do need some kind of financing if you're going to do it right. Yes. So one of the things that's so surprising about this is that they were even able to get $50,000. You know, dollars. Like,
it's true, and that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money in the 1950s in France, especially if you're 25 years old and you've never made a movie before. Well, I'll give an example. Claude Chabrol, who really helps get the ball rolling. And again, I should reinforce that there's a whole bunch of different people, but there's this real cluster of people who wrote for, if I was in my office, I'd pull a copy down, of Cahiers du Cinéma. It's the cinema notebook that still exists. It's a great, great journal. Truffaut, Chabrol, Eric Rohmer, Jacques Rivette, Godard, they're all writing criticism in their teens and early 20s. They're writing criticism. They're reviewing Hitchcock movies and John Ford movies, but also Kurosawa movies, etc. So they are a bunch of buddies who all want to like move from criticism into filmmaking. Claude Chabrol's grandmother dies, and he was from a sort of bourgeois family. His dad was a pharmacist. Anyway, his grandmother died, and he inherited $65,000. Which an average middle class person at that age, what you do is you take that inheritance and you buy an apartment in Paris. That's like, right? It's like an investment and you live there. Instead, he starts his own company to make movies. And he makes his first movie for $50,000. But he also, they have a new government agency that's trying to encourage films that go against the tradition of quality, genre, big budget costume dramas. And win awards. So he gets some money from the government, a low interest loan, basically, to make his movie. So he makes a $50,000 movie, but he only puts like half the money up, the rest the government pays for. He takes the other part of that money and he lends it to a friend of his to make his first feature film. So then as soon as the profits come in from his first movie, which actually gets awards, Beau Serge, he makes his second movie, makes it twice as expensive, The Cousins. I got a poster of it in the back there. And The Cousins becomes one of the top movies of 1959 in France and makes this incredible amount of money. And now he's a producer. He's helping his friends make movies, and he keeps making movies, but he doesn't do the Lucas and Spielberg kind of route of wanting ever more expensive movies. They keep making inexpensive films that are more daring and personal. They don't want to really become the next big commercial filmmakers. They are on their own track to make personal films. And they all look different. They might all be casual, etc., but a François Truffaut film might be very romantic. A Godard film might be more political. I mean, they don't look alike necessarily. They're just working from the same parameters. Low budgets, shoot quick, use new talent that hasn't been necessarily trained in theater and to act. So you get new spontaneous actors. So it's really a really different kind of mode of production. It's a different kind of practice.
And how did they, if they were outside of the studio system, how did they distribute their movies?
That's a really good question. Yeah, France has a looser system back then than we did at that point. So typically, though, what you have to do is sell every movie. So you have to find a distributor who will buy the rights. That's why you go to film festivals. So, for instance, The 400 Blows goes to the famous Cannes Film Festival in 1959 and wins the Best Director Award. So he'd made this film for roughly $50,000 to $60,000 for the final print. He sold the American rights alone for $100,000. It was actually for North America. So a distributor says, this is going to be hot stuff. So somebody buys the rights to Canada and the United States for $100,000. People start to buy other rights for Europe and France, etc. So he's made hundreds of thousands of dollars before it's ever shown in a movie theater. So you have to sort of entice these new, and also a lot of them are kind of small distributors. It's not like MGM is going over there and buying that to distribute. It's going to be a small person who does art films. So they're used to bringing in Fellini movies and Ingmar Bergman movies. And now suddenly there's this new young trend in France, and they're calling it a new wave because there's a wave of new directors coming out. And it sort of helps publicize itself. And you get a whole new generation of distributors starting to get, you know, Janus and these other little companies start to bring it to the United States. Or somebody else will buy the rights for Japan. These things were huge in Japan. Latin America, they were popular. So you get distributors who then will do the distribution and get it to movie theaters.
And one of the things I'm curious about, because anytime you have a trend of something that's fresh and new and is genuinely grassroots, it seems like the studio's natural response would be to kind of duplicate that. Like I remember with... you know, like Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit music video. That was cool for a period of time. And then something like a McDonald's commercial used like the same sort of style of cinematography. And it's like, okay, well, now it's done. Did that ever happen?
Yes and no. There are other things. So then you start to get people after a couple of years who say, well, that's not really a new wave film. That one's not as new wave as this. So you start to get people kind of ranking and controlling them. So you get a bunch of new people trying to have the next new young hot filmmaker as well. But you also get the mainstream reacting against them. A lot of mainstream press did not like these films. They thought they were unprofessional. Jean-Luc Godard, he puts his camera operator in a wheelchair. You know, what's wrong with dollies and cranes? Well, you can't afford them. So things that looked unprofessional or less professional got attacked by the mainstream media. And there's actually even a Jean Gabin, who was the most popular French actor from like the 1930s into the 70s. He was in a movie that the movie poster said, Jean Gabin takes on the French new wave. Basically, you know, he's doing old school good movies, you know, and going to show you what professionalism is. So there was this sort of attack. The other problem is in the early 60s, television came very late to France. So in the 1950s, America has a crisis. People are buying televisions. They can't afford, they're not going to go drive into downtown to watch a movie anymore. They can stay home because they just spent money on this TV and they go to movies less. That starts to happen in France too. French get television about 10 years later than us, and it starts to hurt attendance. And some people said, oh, it's the French New Wave. It's because of these young people that are movie attendance is dropping. So attendance was actually really good in the teens and 20-year-olds to go to French New Wave movies, but the 50 and 60-year-olds didn't go to those movies and wouldn't go to anything else, so the attendance dropped a little. So they were really seen as scapegoats by the mainstream media quite a bit. If anything went wrong, blame the New Wave. But for a new generation of spectators, these were like people like themselves who were making movies about people jumping into bed and talking and having relationships. And as I think Godard again was someone at a film festival who told some of the most established directors, he says, you know, you guys don't know how to make movies anymore because you're getting too old. You know, how can you tell a love story when you're 60 years old? You don't remember what it's like. So it's like that sort of aggressive, you know, young Turks who would just sort of insult the biggest names in cinema and just sort of say, you know, you guys are out of touch. And that led to a lot of anger as well. So,
oh, of course. I mean, if you're the director in your 60s and you take a lot of pride in your work and these young punks you know, filming in wheelchairs come along and say you're out of touch, it's going to...
That's true. No, they were vicious critics, and they were vicious, but they also knew how to market themselves quite well. And this also then excited a whole other generation. So yeah, it was a wide array of people and movies, but it really, as a movement, it started to decline. By mid 60s, there's just not enough room on the screens anymore for that many new movies to come out. And you've got all these filmmakers, Ellen Renee and Agnes Varda, and people are like really popular now. So they keep making movies. I mean, Godard and Chabrol, these guys could make 2 and 3 features a year. They're just constantly shooting films. So they churn out a lot of product. Some of it's successful, some of it isn't. But it kind of crowds out the next generation. And it's not going to be like everybody who's 25 years old and can find $50,000 can become a famous director anymore. It gets harder and harder to find screen time, and things get a little more professional. And you start to get more color films by mid-60s, and they're more expensive. And so that's why it's kind of seen as the late 50s into the mid-60s as the period of the new wave explosion and experiment.
Well, you mentioned the influence of television and people going to the cinema less and less. And of course, that's been accelerated in our time. That's something I wanted to ask you is, with all these streaming services, and you know, the only movies you can see in theaters now are just like giant blockbusters, and like those are fine, but it's definitely not, you know, even a movie like Goodfellas would not appear in theaters nowadays, probably.
The middle ground is kind of gone. Middle films.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, do you think that, you know, with television having an influence back then, people going less to the cinema, is it similar, the situation we're in right now? Or do you think we're so far gone that we could never have?
It's very different. If you talk about cinema per se for a second, yes, it is very different. I also help, I'm on the board of directors for our nonprofit art house in Athens, Georgia, the Cine. And there are fewer and fewer films to pick sometimes, not just because of COVID. But independent films, they're not as popular as they used to be, or there aren't as many getting made as they were. It is a different marketplace today, but I think there are a lot of people who still are very, influenced by the new wave. So if you look at Sean Baker, for example, I don't know if you've heard of Tangerine. He made a movie a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. Tangerine, with an iPhone. He shot a feature film with an iPhone that is just brilliant. It's raucous. It's offensive. It's marvelous. To me, that's sort of the spirit of the French New Wave, that you take new technology, you do something that seems implausible almost to make as well. But in terms of options, there are so many more options now with streaming and things like that. We've got a great Master of Fine Arts new program here too, and instead of people just thinking in terms of, oh, how do I get into an art house, or how do I get my movie distributed, they've got all kinds of other ways to make shows, TV, independent films, etc. So it is a different marketplace in many ways, and I gotta say the new wave is kind of a romantic period back when people, you know, went to art cinemas and you had to search these things out and things like that. So it is a different era. It's a different era, but we've got great filmmakers now. And again, the new wave wasn't just a few amazing people dropping in. It was a whole new generation, new production values. There was space on movie screens. So a whole bunch of factors came together to make it work.
Well, why do you think there are less independent movies now?
Some of it has to do with taxes. Some of it has to do with the 80s and 90s were really the boom time for American independent cinema. There still are independent films. Sundance is still doing fine. But I think there are fewer outlets to a certain extent. What happened is in the last 15 years, a lot of the big studios started to drop their like Fox Searchlights and et cetera. And we still have Sony Classics and A24 and a number of really good distributors who look for material. But theaters are hurting. Frankly, the switch to digital theaters, thousands of American movie theaters closed around 1910, I mean, 1910, 2010, because they couldn't afford to switch to, you know, $150,000 digital projectors when they stopped using 35 millimeter. So a lot of small towns lost their art houses. A lot of big cities have fewer, and there weren't as many screens and stuff, I think. So that's really one part of it, I believe. And a lot of people are going into television. So people who used to make, you know, if Jim Jarmusch was starting out today, would he make Stranger Than Paradise, you know, the same kind of movie, or would he make something for a streaming channel? It's hard to tell. So it's kind of watered down things. But basically, American independent cinema of the 80s and 90s came in when art cinemas were already decreasing, and there were fewer foreign films coming into America. So they kind of filled that gap for young people who wanted something different than Disney and mainstream movies and Rambo stuff as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned Sundance, but even that is something that a lot of the films that get shown there are very, it's not, you know, guerrilla filmmaking.
It's true. No, that's very true.
But that's true. Clearly that wasn't the case back in the 50s and 60s of France. I mean, this was, no. One of the things you mentioned in there was that they were very good at marketing, these directors of the French New Wave, and marketing themselves. How so?
Yes. First of all, a number of them did work for that Cahiers du Cinéma, and their buddies worked there. So there are times in the first years where François Truffaut might write the review for Jacques Rivette's first film, and then Jean-Luc Godard will write the review for François Truffaut's first film. So they're actually like reviewing each other, and they're on the cover of the magazine. And then other friends who run that magazine are going to continue after those guys stop writing. So they had actually that publicity. There was a whole new series in France for television about interviewing filmmakers. So they got a lot of film time. Agnes Varda, who's like was one of the few women, and she just died 2 years ago. Certainly the greatest woman, female filmmaker ever, I think, in world history. She started making her first films in her 20s in the 1950s, and right up till 2019 was making movies. But she's a really good example where she was getting on television, and there's all these great interviews of her. So there was this excitement about the New Wave also, that they would be on talk shows and they would be on interview shows and things like that in France, and flown around the world. Also, I mean, they got to go to, you know, they go to Tokyo, they go to New York. The distributors would bring them in for film festivals. They'd be going to Venice and going to Berlin and at Cannes Film Festival. So the film festivals really were something that really helped a lot to get word out on these people. But there's also a French pride. The mainstream media might make fun of these people, but others want them on their talk shows because they were lively.
Yeah, and the fact
so that helped a lot.
Surely, yeah. And the fact that so many of these people came out as critics from, again, excuse my pronunciation, but Cahiers du Cinéma.
Yeah.
How many people were reading this?
Well, this is the other thing that and I always try to explain this to students because they don't quite get, it's always this glorification of France, but after World War II in particular, there have always been cine clubs, but it kind of burst on the scenes again. After World War II, there was this whole new, again, return to watching movies in clubs. And so what you do is on a certain night in Paris, or also in Lyon and in Marseille and other cities, but there would be cine clubs where you would go and see, it was almost like a film class. There's no videotapes, right? If you want to see an old movie, you either had to go to the Cinémathèque, which France had one of the great Cinémathèques where, you know, every night of the week, they'd be showing two or three movies 7 days a week. So you could go there. It was like education. That's where Truffaut, Godard, et cetera, said, we got our film. We didn't have to go to the film university to study. We went to the Cinémathèque. But they also had cine clubs where somebody would just at a certain movie theater on Tuesday night, for example, every Tuesday night, they'd show a movie and have a discussion afterwards. And so that helped build up a different kind of audience. you'd know where to go for like hip movies and stuff. So it'd be like hearing, oh, there's a cool band playing in Athens. Let's go there tonight. It'd be like, oh, there's this really cool movie, and I think François Truffaut is going to be there to talk about it. So your favorite critic would also show up at a cinematheque, at the cinematheque or at a cine club, and you'd go and be in a theater that you would just sit and have arguments afterwards, and you get to meet other people. And that built a whole new kind of audience. So then they would go out and buy Cahiers du Cinéma or Positif or these different journals. And there's a whole bunch of like six different French film journals came out in the 50s. And so people would be, you know, running out and testing the reviews. What should we watch this week? So they built up a new audience of basically 16 to 24-year-olds who were saw themselves as real film fans and about serious movies too. So they would like want to explore this stuff. So it created a new audience, and they poured then into the art houses, and they read the reviews, and they became fans and for certain of the directors. And they'd argue for Ellen Renée and against somebody else maybe. But it was a really different environment going on at that point. Again, they're not really watching TV much. There's no computer games. So they're, you know, they're listening to rock and roll music and watching new wave films and listening to jazz. It all kind of went together.
If you were someone at that time who wanted to go the traditional route of going into the studio system and becoming a director that fashion, how do people climb that ladder?
There was a very excellent film school, EDEC, and it's now got a different name, but it's considered one of the top five in the world still. Thousands and thousands of people apply every year to go to the French, now it's called FIMAS, film school. It changed its name, but you could work your way up. But typically, the average is if you were going to become an assistant director, you were probably 40 years old. To be a director, the average director would be like 50. It was like working your way up in the military, right? It was a very formal system that you'd get out of college, hopefully get a job as, you know, some kind of assistant to somebody. But generally, or you could go into tracks to become an editor or something like that. But generally, it was, you know, old auteur, big name directors, and then you would have to sort of work your way up and get associated with one of them. Kind of like the Japanese system, where you know you would get under Kurosawa, and you know you don't get to direct films like Kurosawa, but you'd be in his crew. So a lot of people, you got to a certain level and you stayed there. So that's what made the new wave really unusual, was these are people who are directing movies who are never an assistant director to anybody, who were never the gopher for somebody. They never moved lamps and around and microphones for somebody else. They just became in charge. And so it really was two completely different avenues to how do you become a filmmaker. You either do like the guerrilla filmmaking and you find somebody who's, you know, you get out there and you've got a script and you find somebody to help you make it. And you shoot with your, you know, in your friend's apartment, or get your best friend's girlfriend to be the lead in the movie, for, you know, give her $200, or you try to become a more traditional actress and or writer and or editor, et cetera, through the system.
And you use the
Through
word,
tracks.
you use the word auteur, of
Auteur.
auteur, excuse me,
Yes.
the director sort of being the
It's like an
author.
author. It's the French word for author. Yes.
Where did that
It's an
come from?
auteur cinema. So even in commercial cinema, they had these big names who would be great auteurs. So Jean Renoir is very famous, and Sacha Guitry, and yeah, there were these big name people who were considered. Once you got to, you weren't just a director, you became an auteur. That meant you had a certain cachet. And other art filmmakers like Kurosawa, Ingmar Bergman were considered auteurs. Or same with Hitchcock. They had a real something special about them as well. So yeah, French films has always been more director oriented than than we were in the 30s, 40s, and 50s certainly.
Yeah, that's something that I saw Gore Vidal, who was a screenwriter on Ben-Hur and I think a few other movies, where he was saying how he was sort of mocking the auteur style, where the director is at the center of the universe. And he, of course, as a writer, was saying that the
Writers
screenwriter
did.
should be at the center of the universe. And there was some other film critic who I was going to have on the show, I forget his name, but he basically wrote a book about how if you look at, you know, you track screenwriters and they have a better track record for if you have a like a good movie and it's directed by a certain director, if you follow the screenwriter, you're more likely to find a succession of similar quality, you know, films as opposed to the director's track record.
That's a very good point.
Do you feel that way?
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, it's a collective art. It's like, you know, so yes, it does. Pure auteurism minimizes people. It, like, I mean, even Hitchcock. I mean, Hitchcock needed his composers, his editors, the people who helped him rewrite the script and do dialogue. There's a whole bunch of people. So it becomes a branding to a certain extent. So auteurism is kind of a naive notion that, yes, the director is the center. Now, with a lot of the French New Wave movies, a lot of times they wrote the script and directed, whereas Alfred Hitchcock rewrote scripts often. He wrote a few of his things himself, but usually he took a short story or a novel and adapted it and had a scriptwriter working with him. A lot of the French New Wave people really were directing their own script. So they would write it, they directed it. And sometimes that's not good. Sometimes it's very good to have a producer come in and, you know, and or somebody else to say, you know, let's let somebody else, you know, direct your script. But in general, yeah, I think scriptwriters, it depends on the system. France too, they had a really incredible sort of star scriptwriters in the 40s and 50s too, who were in the commercial industry. And yeah, they're going to, they certainly resent the New Wave guys who would, they thought were had scripts that were unstructured and too much improvisation and broke the rules. But yeah, script writing is incredibly important. But if you want loose kind of movies, a loose script that violates the three act structure kind of stuff is going to be essential.
I'm curious in terms of, you know, we're talking about some of the criticisms that the older generation made of the New Wave. And yes. I remember reading an essay of Tolstoy's where he's criticizing Shakespeare and he's looking at King Lear and he's saying, you know, oh, it starts off with this terrible pun about, you know, can you conceive me? And the guy goes, ah, your mother could, or something. Like, it's so stupid. And he kind of has a point. And I disagree with him saying it's a bad play, which surprisingly is his point. But do any of these people have a point when they're sort of making fun of French New Wave?
To a certain extent, yeah. And I think they started to see cliches that the New Wave started. I mean, if you're going to shoot cheap, you shoot in lots of cafes, et cetera. And people started to talk, these you know, young people just talk about, they sit in cafes and talk about love, and then they go and jump in the hotel or in their apartment in bed. And it's just that they started to see them as kind of predictable and cliched to a certain extent. So I think sometimes, but in general, it really was a time of breaking rules and they were influential. The French New Wave film, a lot of people wanted to then make sort of movies that broke editing rules or had unprofessional camera work or shot in the dark. There are a bunch of New Wave movies that get attacked early on where they actually shot at night walking along the street. And if your characters walk past a street light, they're well lit. And then they walk into darkness and they're still having this conversation. So they come in light, go out of light, come into light, go out of light, because they're just walking down a real commercial street at night. And the professionals are going, oh my God, this is horrible. You can't even see her face while she's saying these words. And at the same time, yeah, you go back and look at the professional movies of the era that were carefully lit. They are boring. You can't tell, you know, these things look contemporary. They look real and natural. So I think a lot of the criticism of them was kind of limited. But yeah, they did have some glorification of just young people talking. They didn't always have something really profound to say because they didn't have as poetic a dialogue as some of the official stuff. But there's also some movies that afterwards try to use New Wave tactics in commercial movies, and they start to have fight scenes that are breaking rules, and somebody's looking this way and then that way, like the shower scene in Psycho. A lot of people say, you know, this never would have happened without the French New Wave. Hitchcock loved the New Wave. He was watching what the French are doing. And he's going to say, oh, you know what? I can break continuity. I can have her looking this way and then that way. And other movies started to do that as well. So certain aspects, jump cuts, where you just cut out snippets of a scene so that it just looks like there was a break in the film for a second. Those become huge in commercials because it speeds things up and it grabs your attention. So a lot of their things became used in commercial films later on. It becomes a sort of mainstream and normal. So they have to keep coming up with new ways to innovate how they tell their stories, I think.
Why is that loss of continuity when it comes to, you know, looking one way and the camera turns back and she's looking another way. Why was that considered, a daring rule-breaking thing as opposed to
what you're doing? First of all, just the norm of how you shoot a scene. So if you're going to have two people talking, and this is something, there's a famous French critic, André Bazin, who was a friend of all these young guys, and he wrote this great article saying, the problem with American movies, and this is back in like in the 40s, is no matter what the story is, they're all edited the same, whether it's a love story, an action adventure, a World War II movie, they all have, here's an establishing shot, two people are on a couch. Cut to her saying something, cut to him saying something, cut back to show them as he gets up to go to the door. And he says, it doesn't matter what the theme is, you guys just impose the same editing. So the notion of sort of think, well, should every scene look the same? So breaking the rules where somebody looks this direction and you expect them to see something, and then suddenly the person comes from the other room, is going to break up time and space. It's going to sort of rattle you. Jean-Luc Godard said he did that in Breathless a lot, where you just broke screen direction. You think, well, wait a minute, wasn't she on this side of the room, or was she even in that room? It's like reading a Dick Tracy comic book. In comic books, you get these great little images. They don't all have to add up and be logical. Why do we have to be logical in our movies? So that they would, they would call attention to the camera. Sometimes people would look at the camera and stuff like that. Cameras would get bumped and they'd leave it in. You don't throw that away and reshoot. You'd have editing that calls attention to the fact this is a manufactured product you're looking at. It's not reality unfolding on the screen. So that made it very modern too. Call attention to the editing, call attention to the camera work. You've even got actors talking about other people's movies. In A Woman is a Woman, they're like, oh, how are you doing? Oh, I was just at this such and such a movie that Godard had already made. Or one of his characters walks in and says, hey, hurry up, I got to go home and watch Breathless on TV. The guy's saying, I got to go home and watch Breathless on TV. It starred in Breathless the year before. So they're kind of fun. They're making fun of films. They refer to other films in their own movies. It just calls attention to the fact that we're filmmakers and we know it. As opposed to the sort of genre films and the perfection of a classical Hollywood or a really professional French movie.
The fact that they were calling attention to what they were doing as cinema sort of gets into the last subject I wanted to ask you about, which is the influence of French New Wave. But it reminds me, just to sort of start this off, it reminds me of when people like modernist painters started being very adamant about emphasizing that the canvas is flat. We're on a 2D surface after all, And it seems as though if you look at the history of modern art, you can emphasize that you're on a 2D surface for a long time and then, deconstruct the form and break as many rules as possible. Mm-hmm. And it feels like, I don't know if you saw that, that piece where it was a guy had taped a banana to the wall and then he takes it off and he eats it.
Yes.
Yeah. And that feels as though you've broken all the rules to such a point where now you have just a pile of rubble and you're stomping on the ruins. As someone who it doesn't thrill me as a viewer. In terms of French New Wave, I love this period, but do you feel like there's a limit to these techniques?
Yes and no. There was enough variety, I think, that they weren't just imposing techniques just for the heck of it sometimes. So that they would use jump cuts to show somebody who is seriously, getting chaotic in his mind and stuff. So these are not avant-garde films. They're not like non-representational films. There's lots of those and they're wonderful. So these are narratives. They're just trying to find innovative ways to tell stories that kind of fit their era. But I think some of that stuff then gets reused. So Godard doesn't keep using jump cuts in his movies 5 years later, but other people do. So the legacy is that other people are going to sort of pick up and try to use these things. And they become by then kind of codified, kind of conventional as well. Again, beer ads are going to use jump cuts all over the place and, by mid-60s. But Godard is going to go off on a different level and start using sound to image relations differently and have people talk to the camera more or whatever. So they're just finding innovative ways to do it. I'll tell you, there's a movie that's now becoming kind of hot because it was a famous African-American filmmaker, Melvin Van Peebles, who made a bunch of blaxploitation films in the 70s. He made a feature film in the late 60s in France, found British money to make it. He had a British actor playing the African-American soldier. And then one of the women who was a star, Nicole Berger, who was a star in The New Wave, plays a young French woman who falls in love with this guy on a three-day weekend. And the French attacked it brutally and just said, they're just throwing New Wave tactics into a movie that doesn't need them. So by the mid to late 60s, they're already saying, you know, there are critics saying, hey, you know, how dare you just take these things you think are New Wave and stick them into a very conventional narrative? They just don't fit there. So it'd be like saying, oh, you know, again, you call attention to the screen, call attention to the making once in a rare while during a movie that doesn't really warrant it. So yeah, it'd be like, you know, not, it'd be like having a painting that part of it is going to be three dimensional, have like the illusion of 3D, and then the other part is going to be very flat. It doesn't really fit in the same frame. So it, the legacy is that people start to, a new generation makes movies, and they start to make movies about characters that other people didn't make movies about. They're not Robin Hood, they're not gangsters, they're just sort of average people. And that influenced people all around the world. And that was also part of the modernism, is that they're not telling, not just genre stories, they're not telling genre stories about the typical kind of heroes. And that led to Roman Polanski in Poland. Yeah. He's going to see 400 Blows and say, hell, they made that for $50,000 in the expensive city of Paris. Think what I can do in Warsaw. Same thing happens in Brazil. They start to have a Brazilian new wave later, because they're going to say, well, we can make movies about us. They don't want to make movies that look like the new wave. They want to make movies that are their traditions. So it really inspired a bunch of young filmmakers around the world, including in the United States.
Yeah. And so what then, talking about the filmmakers in the United States, for example, and obviously Roman Polanski came to Hollywood. I talked to writer Sam Wasson, if you've heard of him, who talked about the studio system of the 70s and all like the golden age of movies that came out. How much were they influenced by French New Wave?
Well, quite a bit. And I think, for example, I mean, I don't know, like Bonnie and Clyde, there was even talk about Truffaut and or Godard directing them. People wanted to bring him over. So when Arthur Penn makes a movie, he's going to be strongly influenced. There's a scene just before the Belmondo character, Jean-Paul Belmondo, who just died last year, just before he gets gunned down in Breathless, one of the lenses falls out of his sunglasses on the set. Well, in Bonnie and Clyde, you know, it's a tiny little quote, but the lens falls out of Warren Beatty's sunglasses in the scene just before he gets killed. So there's even these little tributes to it. But the whole notions of how they shot certain scenes, they didn't have covering establishing shots all the time. They tried to have different kinds of music. So a lot of those things are going to owe to the new wave, Five Easy Pieces, a lot of early 70s American movies with meandering characters who don't explain their motives. That comes right out of the French New Wave. You've got these sort of psychologically complex anti-hero characters who are not doing really generic stuff. And in films that are kind of loose and are going to play with style, a lot of that owes to the French New Wave. And the French New Wave owed to other filmmakers before them. It's not like they fell from the skies and invented cool cinema. But it is strong. They are going to strongly influence, I think, screenwriting, acting, and especially editing and directing by the early 70s.
And a lot of these original New Wave directors are still alive, right?
Not many. They're going all the time. Yeah. But no, but yeah, a few people are still left, but not many. Godard is still out there. Yeah. He's won award at Cannes a few years ago. Again, Agnes Varda just got, she was up for an Academy Award the year she died for her last documentary. But very few are left, unfortunately, at this point.
I see. I should say within the past 15 years, there were some.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, and they all made movies right up to the end. Jacques Rivette, Alain René, Claude Chabrol made, I forget, like 70 movies by the time he died. They just kept cranking out stuff, and they've been really important figures. Agnes Varda really, again, is just, you know, I got to know her really well. Agnes Varda was just amazing. Not only did she make documentaries, she made fiction films. She was an advocate for women filmmakers at Cannes Film Festival. But she also did different kinds of art installations and, you know, just all kinds of stuff right up to the end. Again, Godard is still a major figure and considered one of the great, you know, he's the one of the great, great, great directors of all time. And he's just works out of his house in Switzerland. He's, you know, and his own little studio. So yeah, they kept working to the end. Eric Rohmer in particular as well.
Have they made any comments about recent films or the state of the industry?
The last people, not necessarily, no. Okay. But what's funny is that every 5 to 10 years, there's going to be an article somewhere in France saying, is this the start of a new French New Wave? Yeah. They're always looking for new waves. Is there going to be a new generation? And there have been really important, wonderful clusters of filmmakers, but the conditions that will never allow that many people, I think, to enter the industry and change it as dramatically as they did. Although I work on animation also, and especially French animation, and French animation went from almost nothing to the third in the world right now. And a lot of that had to do with daring producers, auteur animators doing things that were just the opposite of Disney and getting festival awards and making money. And really since 2000, for the 2000 to 2010, there was kind of a new wave in animation in France and made them a powerhouse. They win more awards than just about anybody right now. So that too is, so in animation there was one, I think, because of new technology and all kinds of other things. But the new wave is a romantic idea from a long time ago, but it's still inspiring, I think, in lots of ways.
Do you think then that in the same way that like the credo of modernist poetry, Ezra Pound said, make it new. And on that level, like everything that comes after it is, you know, even if it comes under a different term, like postmodernist, whatever, it's still modernist in a sense. It's like, okay, well, you know, you're not going to not make it new. You're going to make it old. Like, is everything kind of the ethos of French New Wave, is all cinema sort of after that going to be somehow affected by it?
Well, yeah, the New Wave says, you know, let's tell new stories in new ways. It's pretty much one of the things that sets them apart. But everybody's trying to innovate. Everybody's trying to do something that is seen as special. It, you know, gets you noticed. But also that you're not just doing the same stuff over and over. So yeah, storytelling has to continually innovate. You can't just use the same flashback structures of the 1940s. You can't just do this. You know, I mean, things change constantly. So yeah, everybody wants to innovate. And everybody wants also to have people see your movies and be popular and have critics like you and somebody buy a ticket. But innovation is certainly behind, you know, everything, even in popular genre films. I'm not against mainstream cinema in any way, but different kinds of independent films in particular owe a lot to this French New Wave and finding new ways to tell stories, engage with that sort of canonical group now of late teens into the 20s and 30 somethings who are really the audience for new films and try to shock sometimes or at least amuse that generation is really important. And it's hard to do now. And it's harder and harder with trying to compete with games and the internet and TikTok and stuff. Like today, it's very hard. A lot of our students never pay attention to what films came out at Sundance or what won at Cannes Film Festival, and those are students who want to become filmmakers. So it's getting harder and harder through all the noise to get attention, I think, for new filmmakers coming up. But it's a great new generation every time.
Since you mentioned the genre films, the last thing I'll ask you is Martin Scorsese made a lot of waves with his remark about the superhero movies being, you know, like an amusement park, and he's like, well, it's not cinema. And some people said he's a snob, and some people are like, well, you know what? There are an awful lot of Marvel movies in theaters now. Do you have any strong feelings either way?
I don't. And in fact, I live in Georgia, where many of the Marvel movies and the Black Panther and particular things like that are shot. And we have a number of people who worked on them. And it's an incredible, like, gigantic machine, but they also generate incredible effects and things like that. And there, I think, you know, they're well done and highly skilled, obviously. Same thing with Star Wars movies. What I just argue is that that shouldn't be all there is. Yes. People shouldn't only watch, you know, independent films and things that aren't popular. And people shouldn't only watch mainstream stuff, but people should have a wide range of exposure. And one of the things that also just does irritate me is that not enough people find out what's going on in international cinema anymore. I think that's one of the problems. If a film student in France or Germany or Hong Kong or Tokyo, they know what's going on in American cinema, but they also know what's going on around the world. They know their Iranian cinema. They know their Indian cinema. American film students in particular don't get enough exposure to what's going on around the rest of the world, I think. And I think that impoverishes a little bit some of mainstream American cinema now. So I don't think there's as much curiosity about what's going on in Taiwan cinema and things like that either. And part of that's even the loss of video stores where you could go wander in and say, oh, what's new this week, and see something different. Now algorithms tell a lot of people what to watch. Oh, you liked that? Here's something else just like it. So I think that's one of the things that I feel bad about, is that people should go back and find things from the past, not just the French New Wave, but if you're interested in naturalism, watch a neorealist movie from the 1940s Italy. There's all kinds of great stuff out there. So I just think that in the movie theaters, there's a variety. Go to an art house like ours, and you can go to the mainstream thing and see a Marvel once in a while. But that shouldn't be the norm. It should just be part of the mix, I think.
On that note, Richard, before we go, do you have your book is History of the French New Wave Cinema. Do you have anything else or anywhere where people can find you?
Just Newport at UGA. I'm very easy to find at the University of Georgia. I also have a brand new book that just apparently appeared on Amazon this week. It's not going to be out for a couple months. I've done a new history of French cinema from the beginning up through World War II. But also, I mean, I don't just do French stuff. I have a book on French animation, but I also have a book on Pixar, the rise of Pixar style, called John Lasseter and the Rise of Pixar Style. And so I'm interested in mainstream CGI stuff as well. So I have a lot of interests. I teach all kinds of different things in film. But the French New Wave is kind of where my heart started getting me into cinema studies.
Excellent. Richard, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed
it. Thank you for your attention and listening to me chatter about the New Wave. I appreciate it.
All right.
Good to see you.
Take care.
All right. Hope that was all right. Thank you.
Thank you to Richard Newport, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.